Hi, I'm Marlon Walker, and I am live from Pelham's Wasteland, and today I have another episode of the podcast for you guys. I think this is going to go out on Monday instead of on Tuesday. That's sort of the plan right now, in which case that'll be, once again, a little bit off schedule, but you know, that's okay. I'm embracing schedule flexibility, especially to pay close attention to when, you know, schedule flexibility allows for maintenance of the sort of things that the schedule is supposed to encourage, right? Which is to say that, you know, tinker with the sort of shit that doesn't matter so that the shit that does matter happens, right? Like the idea of, you know, if you have a, right, recognize what purposes things exist for, and that therefore the ways in which the kind of specifics of what perhaps you do as a habit or things like that are flexible because other things can fulfill the same purpose, right? Anyway, so it is currently Sunday afternoon. It's a little after 5 p.m. I technically have a couple more hours left on the schedule to write for a little bit. We'll see if I end up putting any more words on the page over the course of this afternoon and evening, right? But you know, it's one of those things that is, you know, we'll see. Anyway, basically the short answer is I'm at about, I think I'm technically at a little over 8,000 words right now. I don't know. Scrivener is funny the way that it keeps track of word count, because it only keeps track of word counts that are in the kind of sections that are going to be compiled into the document, which is good in the terms of, you know, not having like your notes fill up the word count when they shouldn't, but also the way that my process works involves moving things into the compiled document section when I'm kind of ready to actually compile them, and otherwise not having them in there. So I don't know. I don't feel like calculating exactly, but I think I'm at right about 8,000, maybe even a little above in terms of total words on the novella project, which is a really, I think it's worth stating there's two big points that I feel like I should make about that. And the first one is embracing the idea of, like I think I've talked about before, the 70% is not as good as 100%, but it's way better than 0%, right? That, you know, sure, 8,000 words is not 20,000, but it is also, you know, 8,000 more than I had at the start of the weekend, and is vastly more than I've written, you know, in months and years recently. So that's pretty good. And also another kind of thing that took me a while to put into words is the idea of, if you depend on failures to learn, embrace controlled failure, which is to say that, you know, uncontrolled failure is particularly uncomfortable, right? But controlled failure is actually maybe okay, right? That's sort of within the procedure almost, right? Is to, you know, set up your goals in such a way that controlled failure happens so that you have an opportunity to learn. In the same way that another kind of way to describe it is that if you get 100% on the test, that tells you things that you know, but it doesn't tell you everything that you know, which is to say that you only really, right, you only really find out what things you need to learn once you get to a test that is hard enough that you don't get 100% anymore, right? as a kind of way of thinking about that, which is the value of setting unfulfilled goals and accepting a level of unfulfillment while also doing your best to reach them, which is kind of a complicated balancing act. So anyway, it's a whole thing. But I guess what I'm saying is I did not end up with a complete novella after a weekend worth of writing. I also didn't write for as much time as I had kind of scheduled. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that too, probably in the next section. But at the same time, it is an energizing and ennobling failure, right? That it you know, I think is kind of exactly what I need and you know, is a source of a tool to push myself to be better, essentially, which isn't that what we all need sometimes? I don't know. But anyway, so that's sort of where I am at right now. Anyway, so let's get into the episode. Oh, in addition to talking about the writing project, I also have a whole bunch of other kind of ideas that I've been working on, kind of bouncing around in my head in some ways. I'm probably going to talk about a couple of them in this episode, maybe probably not in as much detail and depth as they deserve, but as just sort of a almost like an announcement that that's something that I'd like to talk about further, I guess. So anyway, yeah. All right. So a little bit more about the creative writing project. So I ended up, one of the things that I had tried to do was to do very little ahead of time specifically, which is to say that I was really trying to emphasize this idea of, you know, start on time and then do it without kind of prep ahead of time. Because I think one of the things specifically that makes things easier for me often has to do with, you know, splitting up the time in ways that are useful to me, right? That's one of those things that I found a lot of advantage in, especially recently. And that's a useful tool in the arsenal, but it kind of, you know, tinkers with the expectations around kind of the project and the use of the project as a diagnostic tool in some ways. So anyway, I also, it's a good reminder of something that I have known for a long time. And that is basically that, you know, if you want to do hours and hours of a particular thing that requires focus and dedication, you need to block out more time than just the time for that thing, which is to say that there's a startup time and energy that it takes to kind of get into super, super focus mode in some ways, often, not necessarily always, but at least to do it consistently. And, you know, worst case scenario, if you're, you know, able to get in immediately and get out right immediately, then you have extra time that you scheduled, right? But the idea being that, you know, want to write for 6 hours in a day, probably need to schedule more like 8 hours of alone time with nothing else going on in order to make that happen, or accept that, you know, a scheduled 6 hour block is going to be more like, you know, 4 or 5 hours of writing with a hour or so of other stuff that is important to the process, but is not necessarily kind of actually, you know, sitting and typing away, right? That's a whole thing. But yeah, in general, I felt really good about the whole thing. I think there's another reminder, which is that I think I've done a good job of trying to counteract kind of executive dysfunction with regard to writing, which is important, right? That's a big deal by itself. But it executive dysfunction is not the only source of writing as an arduous process for me, which is to say that, you know, even with a lot of these tools, and I think a fair bit of it is habit, right? A fair bit of it is what you're, you know, used to and comfortable with and all of that sort of stuff. But I have said for a number of years that, at least for me, writing, or at least writing well, is an arduous process, right? It takes a lot of, not even necessarily that much kind of time typing, but a lot of energy put into the creativity in a lot of ways, which is a an important point, right? That it's just a, you know, takes a lot of work to write well, right? Which is to say, I think it takes a lot less work to write less well, but I don't really want to write less well. And that sort of speaks to what I am interested in. And I do think that there's some, I do think that there's a real benefit in reducing executive dysfunction and being able to kind of start writing relatively easily. But that doesn't mean that, you know, writing for an hour even is an easy task, right? That I feel like, you know, by today, after Friday and Saturday, I did not get a whole lot done in terms of actual kind of direct productivity. And I think a lot of that has to do with just being kind of worn out from 2 days of fairly focused writing. It also has a little bit to do with some kind of external circumstances, which is to say that on Friday, I felt awful. I felt like I was having really, really serious allergy symptoms, which I suspect is directly related to having had a beer with dinner on Thursday night at my parents' house, which is something that I like to do, but it's also a reminder when I woke up on Friday that for people who suffer from really intense allergies, when your body is busy breaking down alcohol, it's not busy breaking down histamines. And so your allergies get worse from having alcohol in your system that needs to be dealt with, which I think for most people is probably not hugely significant. But for me, I feel like I, you know, got very little done until maybe 11 a.m., which is a pretty slow start to a morning, especially if you want to be, you know, sitting down and writing by about one. That it was definitely not about one when it was probably 2:30 by the time that I actually got kind of sat down and ready to start being kind of focused and productive. And that was after not just getting stuff done, but also kind of taking a lie down essentially for a little while to sort of, you know, do what I felt like was necessary to recover in some ways, just from being, you know, my bad headaches and all of that sort of stuff, coughing up post nasal drip. And anyway, all of that is to say, not the best circumstances for focused creativity, but that's fine, right? That, you know, not perfect, although it is also a reminder that there's always extenuating circumstances, right? There's always something going on beyond just the kind of, you know, absolute zero. And part of the point of that being to, you know, learn and improve for next time and all that sort of stuff. So anyway, but I kind of spent a while on Friday building first a kind of file structure in Scrivener, which is the particular tool that I like to use for writing. Scrivener is from a company called Literature and Latte. And what it is essentially a word processor with a fairly sophisticated set of features for what is equivalently essentially having multiple files, right? That instead of having like a folder with a bunch of Word docs, one for each chapter, or, you know, having a bunch of Google Docs or things like that, that what you do is you build everything in Scrivener, right? And so you have folders and files, although you can also nest files within files, essentially, so that you have like a section of text and then a section of text kind of within that. And you can build this structure, but then you can also do some pretty cool stuff, especially for, I know a number of what I actually first found out about it, not for creative writing, but for nonfiction writing, especially for long nonfiction, right? Like a dissertation or a thesis, where you need to keep track of a ton of material. That one of the things that Scrivener has is you can link files that exist on the computer into the Scrivener project and have them be sort of a part of your workspace, for lack of a better term, right? So if you have like if you're writing a thesis and you have a bunch of articles and essays and books and things like that that you're citing, you kind of build the organizational structure in there and create a whole kind of basically a tool to help you kind of keep track of everything that you're trying to use, which is, you know, once you start getting into like a 100-page long essay or more, right, this starts to be helpful to have the tools do some of the work for you, right? Because it's very hard to keep track of that much stuff just in your head, right? Anyway, but Scrivener also, I don't remember how much it is. It's like $40 or something. And I bought it a couple of years ago. It's a lifetime license from Literature and Latte. And it is now, updated to the third edition. That there was Scrivener 1, which was for Windows and Mac, and then Scrivener 2 that was only for Mac. And then for a long time, Mac was on Scrivener 3 and Windows was still on Scrivener 1. And then they figured out how to move Scrivener 3 to Windows also. So now it's all updated and pretty and all that sort of stuff. And I believe that if you get it now, you will have to buy Scrivener 3. And I don't remember how much it is. But anyway, it's a, in my opinion, a really useful tool for writing beyond just having a kind of, you know, text editor to write into, right? Having all of that sort of stuff available is an aid, especially when you're talking about like more long-term composition, right? So like one of the things that I did was I had a whole, and going forward, as I work on finishing this project, because I would like to bring it to at least a kind of complete first draft that somebody could, you know, sit down and read through and follow what's happening and all that. But you can create, so like, for instance, I had a folder that's all kind of prep work, right? Lists of characters and lists of, you know, all sorts of things like that, and an outline for kind of roughly what I was thinking was going to go on in the story, and then also sort of built the outline in file structure within the binder, is what they call it, which is the sort of all of the list of files associated with the project, right, including the text files that exist within Scrivener. As a way to like be able to really very easily kind of see, okay, so, you know, I've got the outline, this section of the outline is this document, and this document doesn't have any text in it yet, but I'm going to, you know, be able to, you know, work on, maybe even I could write, you know, like a two or three sentences of expansion on one sentence in the outline to get a better idea of what I want to put here. And then when I'm ready to kind of come to that section and write it out as not summary, but kind of full actual text, that I have kind of more notes for myself almost. So that's, I think, a good solution in a lot of ways. But yeah, it was a fun project, tremendously wearying in a lot of ways, but that's okay. And I think it also gets into You know, it's a classic thing where, you know, at least most of us just don't have the mental energy for hours and hours and hours of focus, right? Back in, I think it was during the Vietnam War that the particular study went on. It was basically about how long can, it was a, the U.S. military studying, how long can a soldier be basically on watch and be efficiently on watch? The idea being not just kind of standing there visible to anybody else watching, but, you know, focused and paying attention and alert to signs of danger and things like that. It's only like 3 hours, right? Which if you think about being awake for 16 hours, you know, 3 hours is less than a quarter of your day for focused time. Now, what they found was that actually you could sort of get more out of them if you were willing to do some, you know, rotational tricks, right? That given guys who are going to be on watch a chance to sort of, you know, take a break and take a breather and recover and, you know, not have to stay focused, you could get more total focused time out of them efficiently. And I think that's a big thing to keep in mind for something like this next time, is thinking about how both how to build up kind of focus endurance and also how to, you know, like schedule in, not just kind of break when you feel like it, but remind yourself to like take breaks as a deliberate way of taking a break before you feel it, right? In the same way of like drinking water before you're desperately thirsty, all of that sort of stuff, right? Put it on a schedule, and then you can be flexible with the execution of the schedule, right? If you're, you know, in the middle of something and schedule says, hey, it's time for a break, and you say, oh, nope, I need to write, get this idea on paper now, 5 more minutes, you know, hit snooze button on taking a break, that's fine. But, you know, have it as a feature, right? And this gets back to, you know, using, making your tools work for you, right? So anyway, that's a whole thing. But it was a lot of fun. I had this idea that if I had ended up with something, it's, you know, terrible passive voice right there. But if I had ended up with something, kind of like a complete first draft, I would, you know, put it up on you know, on my Google Drive and link to it or something like that, who knows, which I'm not going to do, because it is not in a finished readable state so much. But part of it has to do with the way that I kind of approached with that sort of fragmentary structure that I was describing, the idea of having, like, you know, individual text pieces. And I sort of, rather than trying to like write from the beginning all the way through, part of my idea was, okay, well, you know, just write like, you know, scenes that sound interesting to you, and embrace the idea that if things don't fit together perfectly, that's for the editing stage, right? That's a different issue. And so sort of rather than kind of trying to, you know, write from the top and spit out text until you get to the bottom, sort of inject into all sorts of interesting different places along the course of the project in order to kind of grow from all directions at once almost, which I think was an interesting direction to move. Difficult to do in a number of circumstances, but really rewarding to at least try in this case. So I'm excited to kind of tinker more with that, that sort of style of creativity, right? Rather than start from the beginning and tell through, and just kind of, you know, put material on the page that is useful to the story as a whole and accept that some level of editing is going to be necessary to kind of make all the disparate parts that were kind of crafted at different times into a cohesive whole. But that's what editing is for, right? So, and don't be so scared about doing a little bit of editing, because editing is just arduous work too. But that's okay. Arduous work is acceptable. That's what it takes. Anyway, so yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is that it was not a success in the sense that I now have a completed draft of a novella in digital form on my hard drive, but I think it very much was a sort of meta success as far as an aggressive target and a lot of time spent writing and really kind of getting into and understanding what it would take, right? Because I think one of the big things now is I have a much better understanding of, okay, so if I wanted to do something like this again, or wanted to be like a normal person and write over the course of, you know, an hour a day for days instead of, you know, 6 hours and then 6 hours and then 10 hours, right? What does that take, right? What does it require of me to be able to do something like that? And do I kind of have it in me to do something like that? And I think the answer is, sort of remarkably, well, yeah, I think all that stuff is totally doable. And especially kind of, after an ambitious failure, right? Maybe the thing to do is to come back with a less ambitious, but no less meaningful success, right? Anyway, that's sort of my thoughts right now. But I'm feeling really good about it, aside from the fact that I feel like I could sleep for about 12 hours. We'll see. Maybe I will sleep for 12 hours. Who knows? I guess it's 5:45 right now. So if I go to bed at 8 p.m. and wake up at 8 a.m., that would be 12 hours. We'll see. Maybe. Anyway, that's writing. All right. So what else has been... what else have I been thinking about? What's been going on? All of that sort of stuff. There were some other, I think fair to say, some other good successes over the weekend. In particular, so on Saturday morning, I did breakfast or brunch with my parents and my aunt and my grandmother over at my parents' house. And then in the evening, did lunch with my parents and my sister and her partner and a different set of grandparents, ended up being, 5+ hours, maybe 6 hours of kind of high chaos family time, which as someone who is pretty deeply introverted, it's probably part of why I feel like I could sleep for 12 hours or more, to be honest. But that's okay too, right? I think what I'm sort of getting at there is that, I think that by itself would be a pretty remarkable success most weekends in terms of kind of, being able to feel like I, could handle that kind of high chaos, high interaction time, basically, that, that obviously they're all people that I love very much and care about deeply, but also that, I need some space from sometimes because it's not easy to interact with, especially some of the people listed for extended periods of time, without kind of prep and trying to kind of, armor up, or for lack of a better term, it sounds terrible, but I hope you know what I mean. Anyway, and basically it's a bigger thing, that it really has to do with kind of introversion and my particular neurodivergencies and all of that sort of stuff, and the way that that is a factor in my interaction with lots of people, and in particular the way that that means that certain forms of interaction that are much easier for other people are more difficult for me, and certain ones that are much more difficult for me or much easier for other people, right? In particular, I think one of the big things that I have recognized is that online interaction is just excellent for me, right? That being able to, like, you know, chat with my friends on Discord or something over audio and even with video on from webcams, but in my own space, sitting at my own chair in front of my own computer, rather than kind of out at like a bar or something like that, is awesome for me, right? That it is vastly less taxing than kind of other forms of interaction, which is important to recognize that that's not true for everybody, right? That, you know, there are definitely people, and this is a sort of general thing of, you know, people who are suffering from the particulars of especially kind of pandemic lockdown and things like that. But there's also an element of, oh, all the extroverts are suddenly really concerned about the way that, you know, interaction needs that are not correctly fulfilled cause mental anguish. Kind of funny how that happened, huh? Which is basically to say that, you know, a bit of a taste of your own medicine there, boys. Anyway, which is spiteful, but I don't care. I'm allowed to be spiteful sometimes. As long as you use spite to improve, then it's okay, right? That's the whole point, is, you know, be spiteful towards extroverts who suddenly care about mental health and the relationship to fulfilled social needs. But use that as a way to drive for a better solution in the future, right? That we don't have to just go back to the way things were, because even though this is very uncomfortable for a lot of people, the way things were uncomfortable for a lot of other people. And, you know, worth recognizing that, you know, nobody has to be like that, right? We don't have to build a system that is built on human suffering, that that's such a central feature of just the way things work, right? And I think that's one thing that the pandemic, terrible as a number of the elements have been, in particular the, you know, immense loss of life that has happened, and also the kind of general level of suffering that has happened with a lot of people who have gotten it but who haven't necessarily died from it, right? Long COVID is a pretty serious scourge and is going to get worse. But part of the point being that it is also illuminating for the flexibility of the system, that, you know, a real demonstration of the way that a whole lot of things that were sort of always presented as set in stone, this is the way things are demonstrated to be the result of choice, right? Human decisions, political will, all of those things. And, you know, that means they're not set in stone. That doesn't necessarily mean that they have to change or even that they should change, but it means they can change. And that's an important point to recognize, right? That, you know, for instance, we don't need, you know, one of the ones, and I'm going to get into this a little bit, is that my mom has been really, really interested in, she is a city planner by trade and has been working with regard to kind of advocacy or awareness around issues with regard to transportation, especially with regard to highways. And part of the point is that highways are really good for getting people from one spot to another, but they're not nearly as good for a number of other things. And sometimes we, you know, it's a matter of having the right tool for the right job, right? If you need to drive 3 hours from Austin to Houston, a highway is really convenient. If you are trying to get from, you know, central Austin, where the University of Texas is, to East Austin, then I-35 being in the way is a huge limiter of east-west movement, which is to say that they basically put it right there because they put it at the western edge of the African-American neighborhoods in East Austin to create a barrier between, you know, the African-American neighborhoods and the rest of Austin, right? That's basically by design, right? It's not an up for debate sort of thing, right? We have the records of exactly like how those decisions were made, and all that sort of stuff. And in particular, with regard to Austin, there's actually a whole nother highway that they built that goes around Austin, but it is tolled. And so a whole lot of the traffic doesn't take SH-130 that goes around Austin. It goes on I-35 up through Austin, and therefore, you know, tears apart the fabric of the city, basically, is the argument. And part of the point being, in particular, that the way that we allocate money towards highways really hides the cost of highways, which is to say that we fund highways by, you know, everybody pays, well, not everybody pays taxes to the federal government, but everyone who makes less than millions of dollars a year pays income tax to the federal government. And that's the, you know, one of the primary sources of income for the federal government. Obviously, there are other sources of income. And then they give a hunk of that money back to state DOTs, Departments of Transportation, which are basically just highway departments, right? What they do is they build highways, which means that they don't talk about exactly how much the highways are going to cost. It's not nearly as high profile as, for instance, when a city wants to build good public transit, and that goes on a bond, and because that's how cities pay for things. And that means that everyone in town knows exactly how much money they're talking about putting on the bond, and in particular, how that's going to affect their property taxes, which are how the city makes money. Part of the point being that when you actually look at the numbers, right? So for instance, Austin passed a thing called Project Connect recently, which is a big bond package for a whole bunch of public transit solutions, expansions to bus service and rail-based public transit and things like that in a number of places, kind of connecting a lot of the different parts of Austin. Part of the point is that the amount of money that was talked about for that bond package was considered, you know, huge when you talk about the scale of the project, right? That it's a lot of money when you look at it directly. Costs less than 1 mile of one lane of I-35 that TxDOT wants to build, right? TxDOT wants to build an almost 20-lane wide highway on I-35. And we're talking about miles and miles of I-35 at basically 20 lanes wide. And 1 mile of one of those lanes would cover all of the public transit. And part of the point has to do with, right, you know, efficient use of resources, right? And this is how it ties back to gaming, because all trad games are basically just resource management simulators, which is kind of intentionally manipulatively simplistic, but also sort of true. Like most good jokes, there's a truth in there, which is to say that part of the point has to do with input of information. And this also gets into something I've been thinking a lot about, which is, right, that good output is dependent upon good input and good process, which has kind of a number of different forms. What I sort of started thinking about that in regard to writing, right? That, you know, not everyone who reads well writes well, but there are basically nobody who writes well who does not read well, right? That, you know, you could maybe make the case of, well, I think that the argument that there are any significant number of people who do not read well but do write well is really just not evidence, not supported by the evidence, right? Which is to say, right, that's your input and your output, right? Reading as input, writing as output. There's process in there too, right? That you have to, you know, actually sit down and put words on paper, but part of the point, but that it also works for lots of other things, right? Information input as being a necessary prerequisite for good output, all sorts of other things, right? Like exercise, right? Both in the sense of, you know, like paying attention to what people with expertise and research around exercise talk about, but also in the sense of just like, you know, paying attention to the condition of your body as like a physical entity, right, is really important for exercise and health related to that, right? That, you know, you need to know. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to listen and do exactly what your body wants you to do, right? Sometimes your body says, oh, please, not one more rep. And you say, you know what? We're going to do it anyway. And that's actually good for you. But you have to at least listen to the please, not one more rep bit of that. Otherwise, you end up hurting yourself because you try to do too many more reps, right? That's sort of the point that I'm getting at, is that, you know, not taking in that information is makes it impossible to guarantee good output, right? Which is to say, you might still have good output. You might, you know, you might get lucky, but you're dependent upon getting lucky rather than being smart, right? And that's a, right? You can only get lucky for so long, especially when you're talking about habits that are good for you, but that have kind of, you know, destructive consequences at either end of the bell curve, right? In the same way that, you know, you can ride your motorcycle 100 miles an hour on the highway to get your jollies, but you can't do that forever, right? Eventually, you can't keep doing that. Anyway, which is not a call out to anyone specific. I realized after I said it that sounds like me trying to throw shade on my buddy Jason, and it is not at all. I don't believe that you are riding your motorcycle at speeding or anything like that, Jason. I really, at least I hope you're not. It was more about the general idea of kind of, you know, thrill seeking and thriving on chaos and all that sort of stuff, and the way that all of that is useful, but it also comes at a cost, right? And that there is a real, you know, can't do that forever, right? You can't behave in sort of adrenaline junkie, thrill seeking way forever, because eventually your luck runs out. Or you figure out how to manage those impulses, right? That being kind of part of the point, is that, you know, you actually sort of, you can sort of do some of those things forever. You just have to be smart about it, right? And also, nothing is forever, right? Everything is disposable. Some things are just differently disposable, which is an important point too, right? You don't get to keep the carbon, which is kind of grim, but whatever. Eventually somebody else is going to use it, and that's okay too. But yeah, and then there are a couple other, there's a number of things I've been sort of thinking about. And I think a big part of it has to do with the way in which, you know, trying to think about anything other than the work that I was supposed to be doing, you know, stand up and take a walk and think about anything else, means you end up thinking about some kind of interesting things. And I'm going to end up sort of talking about those at other times, but it has to do with things like, you know, games as the right tool for the job, which is also, I think, an illuminating metaphor, because, you know, not all tools are created equal, which is to say that, you know, most jobs have a tool associated with them, but there are some tools that don't really fit any job, right? You can imagine like a hammer that doesn't have the head well attached to the handle, where when you try to swing it and you hit something with it, the head twists or jiggles on impact, and so it doesn't transfer force effectively, right? That's not just a, right? That's a broken tool, right? And part of the point being to talk about this discussion of evaluating RPGs, that if the metaphor, if the guiding metaphor is going to be, you know, right tool for the job to create the, you know, RPGs as a tool to create a specific experience, that it should be considered whether or not that means that, you know, the difference between right tool for the job means that every RPG has its place, and right tool for the job means that some RPGs are just bad tools. Right, which I think is a kind of interesting discussion. And then I've also been thinking about kind of citation of sources in development. In particular, there was a Twitter thread that I read that I shouldn't have. I think it was it was earlier today. That was just a dude being an absolute tool, but whatever. For some reason, I have a lot of less self-control about just, you know, just stepping away. But anyway, part of it had to do with the idea of kind of RPG development as an iterative process and this kind of, you know, who did it first thing, which is to say that in the specific example, there was talk about superhero games, and there was a discussion about Wild Talents, which is a superhero game that is on the One Roll engine. And one of the examples that they talk about in the book is building a superpower that allows you to basically stop the process of nuclear fusion that is going on in the sun that makes everything go, right? That you could actually build that as a power. And basically the dude who was being a tool was like, well, Champions did it first, and then talked about the Champions character that sort of did something similar, although it's a little different. And I think part of the point getting into that is that, you know, the Champions did it first thing, I think, is a really interesting kind of argument through subtext, which is to say that, you know, doing it first is not the same as doing it best. And arguably there's a real, right, there is a real value in sort of pushing the boundaries of all of the different kind of things that can be done with RPGs and all that sort of stuff, right? Creating kind of inventive and innovative ideas for the sort of culture of RPGs as a whole, right? And so doing things first is useful in that sense, but also doing things first is not the same as doing them best, right? Which is to say that, you know, if the argument is about, well, which game should we play in our limited amount of time to play games this week, right? Whichever game did something first, that's not an argument necessarily in that game's favor, especially when you consider the value of kind of iteration in development of systems and the way that, you know, sure, maybe Champions did it first, but does that mean they did it best? In fact, I think the point that I'm getting at is that in some ways, I think the argument is that actually the Wild Talents people who saw what Champions had done and then did something kind of a further step on top of that, right? It's kind of like the whole standing on the shoulders of giants thing, right? That you're standing on the shoulders of giants, but you're also, you know, higher up than the giants are, right? The giants may be bigger, but you're higher up. And this has to do with the idea of, like scientific development over time, right? That, you know, I don't have to be nearly as wicked smart as Isaac Newton was to be able to understand mechanics, because I've got Isaac Newton to teach me about Newtonian mechanics, right? Because he wrote that shit down, which is useful for people who are not as wicked smart as Isaac Newton was. And this is sort of the point that I'm getting at. And in particular, I think it has to do with the way that the kind of, you know, who did it first element, I think actually especially when that is presented as kind of an argument through subtext, which is the case that I'm making about what was going on here, is that it actually is less good for the kind of communal development of all of these things. In particular, I was comparing it to something that I saw earlier today, which is I was looking through this guy, Luke Gearing is the guy's name, and he has a number of products on itch.io, and they're cool, and I haven't bought any of them yet because I spent all my money, but when I get paid later this week, I will probably buy at least one or two things from him. In particular, he has a blog post that is just called Violence, and it's basically a very, very simple system for running for RPG combats, right? It's the indie RPG sphere is really into this kind of idea of like lo-fi systems, as in like, you know, low fidelity, as in like there's not a lot of kind of mechanical stuff going on in the system that is designed to kind of model all the different things that are happening. You just sort of roll the dice and interpret rather than kind of structuring the role to reflect the system, to reflect the situation and all that sort of stuff, right? It's very relatively simple system. It's pretty easy to use. There's some cool stuff on it. And in particular, one of the things that Luke has, it's a blog post, and I'm going to link it in the show notes. And he's got a series of updates on the kind of development of this system. And in particular, he talks about kind of exactly where he got a lot of these ideas from, right? That he says, like, you know, I added so update 14/05/2021, which I assume is May 14th, because it looks like, right, there isn't a 14th month, added a better system for disadvantage, and there's a slash, so it's disadvantage and advantage, cribbed from Shadow of the Demon Lord, right? And this is, I think, actually really, really good, because it talks about, you know, sources for material, and that is actually something really, really valuable, right? To talk about RPG development as a kind of general sort of like cultural element, right? To talk about where you got things from, almost, right? Citation of sources. And in particular, part of the point being that if Luke himself, I assume himself, I don't see Luke's preferred pronouns listed on the page, but anyway. If Luke was sort of more concerned about the idea of kind of making a case about who did it first, right? That wouldn't be an element of the discussion, right? That you would hide those sorts of things as a way to pretend that you did it first, right? Try not to let him know where you took it from, right? And I think that is actually not as good. I think what is best for the kind of development of RPGs in general is a kind of very, very open approach to stealing shit that you like and being willing to say where you got it from, right? Because I think that's an important thing too. So that the people who look at your stuff can go back to where you got it from and kind of see the development rather than having to do the kind of intellectual archaeology to figure out how it developed, right? Which is a whole thing. But I think this ties into this idea of, you know, who did it first versus who did it best type stuff, right? Which is to say that, you know, in as much as there's nothing new under the sun, there's nothing wrong with stealing ideas from other people because they stole them too, right? Which is to say that if they were their own ideas, they would have invented a language themselves to express them in. Because the language is somebody else's too. Anyway, I think that's going to be it for this section of the podcast. Yeah, I think that's going to be that. So yeah, let's close it up. Let's go to the outro. Why not? All right, that's the whole episode. That's all I got. That's what's going on. I'm thinking about shifting schedules around again a little bit, which is one of those things that I suspect all of you who listen to the podcast perhaps are not as excited to hear, especially since I shift schedules, or I guess it's been a while since I've been going for the kind of, you know, two podcasts a week schedule for a couple months now, so it's not like I'm shifting schedules every week, right? But the idea sort of being to and it's less relevant to the podcast actually compared to the YouTube channel, but one of the big things being that YouTube takes up and the podcast both take up a fair bit of time within my week, right? And if I really want to prioritize the time, right? And especially with this idea that, you know, you only get the, you know, everybody gets the same 24 hours in a day. It's about how you spend it. And in my case, I need to spend a lot of those hours doing all sorts of shit that is necessary for me to function in a lot of ways, especially the kind of core point about, like, you know, 16 hours a day awake, 8 hours a day asleep, right? It's a fair bit of time asleep, right? But also, right, that's what it takes, right? That, you know, I don't function on less than 8 hours of sleep. And also, you know, I don't want to die of a heart attack when I am 45 by virtue of the amount of kind of caffeine and stimulants it would take to keep me going on 5 or 4 hours of sleep every day for an extended period of time. So anyway, that's a whole thing. But yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those things that is important to be aware of, but also, you know, it's the way things are. And it's okay to not necessarily, right? You don't have to like things to engage meaningfully with them, right? I think that's sort of the point, right? You don't have to be a fan of the way that these things work to engage with them, right? It's like the meme that you all may have seen sometime of the, you know, you criticize society and yet you are a member of it. And it's like, yeah, well, not really a lot of options there, which is the whole point of that meme, is that there aren't a lot of options there. And so, you know, you kind of got to, right? Especially if you're one of those people that, you know, needs antidepressants to function and things like that, because that's helpful. You know, being a part of society is helpful for that sort of thing too. Anyway, all of which is basically to say that, yeah, I've got a lot of stuff on the go, but I am thinking of tinkering with things just a wee bit to try to figure out how to make everything work the way I want it to, right? That's sort of the point, right? Is to, you know, make things how you want them to be and all that. And in particular, part of the point being that, what was I trying to say? Part of the point being, in essence, that there's a real advantage, at least to me, in clear and analytical analysis of all of this sort of stuff, right? That I don't have a way to deal with a lot of this stuff that I'm talking about without approaching it in that direction, right? That's how I function, right? Which is okay, right? Everybody functions one way or another, or they don't function, which is, you know, how some people go. But, you know, that's the point that I'm getting at has to do with the idea of, you know, trying to embrace functionality that works for me, especially in my own spaces, right? Part of the point being that, you know, when I'm interacting with other people, it makes sense to, you know, be flexible and do things that work for everybody, right? Not to try to kind of dominate the way that things happen in spaces that are not just me. But, you know, if I'm on the podcast or I'm, you know, sitting in my own apartment where I live by myself, I'm going to do things the way I want to do them, that work for me, not the way that anybody else feels like they should be done. Because fuck them and all that, because they're not me and they don't know necessarily. So yeah, make things work for you, right? Make the tools work for you and all that, I guess, is sort of what I'm getting at in some ways. I don't know. I'm very much rambling at this point. Once again, Jason threatened to stop listening because I ramble so much. And to be honest, he would probably be right to do so. Because, yeah, so many rambles. But anyway, yeah, that's kind of what's going on with me. Yeah, working on figuring out what's going to work for me and all that. So anyway. Yeah. I should say the things that I say at the end of an episode so that everybody knows that it's done. Thank you so much for listening. Hope everyone is doing well, staying safe, staying healthy, and having lots of fun gaming. I've been Arlen Walker. I've been live from Helm's Wasteland, and I will see you next time. Take care, everybody.